Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I don't look at the calendar anymore this time of year. I dread this day. But not because of anything that might happen. It's the whole ritual of 9/11 that I am through with. I was actually done with the whole 9/11 thing sometime between the famous and politically disastrous mission accomplished moment of George W. Bush after the Iraq invasion, and that empty announcement by Barack Obama that this feeble terrorist mastermind Osama bin Laden had been killed by Navy SEALs in Pakistan. I'm done with the whole heroes thing. Aren't we over this? The American tragedy story and the talk of America as the preeminent victim of terrorism? America isn't even close to being the most victimized nation by terrorism. If anything, we are more victim of our own domestic terrorism than from any foreign enemies, even though it's convenient and easy to fear them more than kids with guns who wander into churches to kill. I cannot deny people's grief who lost loved ones that day. I wouldn't think of it. People who were in the towers. I cannot deny the tragedy of those who couldn't make it out. But I think the 9/11ization of American life has been a kind of poison for all of us. We had our moment when the whole world was with us after 9/11, and we squandered it. We spent trillions on two wars that turned one battlefield into a killing field for ISIS and a refugee tidal wave from Syria and Iraq, and another battlefield in Afghanistan into a fragile puppet government that rules over the biggest opium crop in the history of the world. Some of that Afghan heroin finds its way into our cities, where it kills and destroys lives much more easily than flying planes into towers. I'm just done with 9/11. If you don't agree, or if you think I'm being disrespectful, I'm sorry. And I don't begrudge others' feelings about this. But I can't help feeling a little cheated by the whole thing. I can't get over this remark George W. Bush made back in 2003, trying to explain to all of us how 9/11 had changed America.
But it was very difficult to link a terrorist network and Saddam Hussein to the American soil. As a matter of fact, it was very difficult to link any attack on the American soil because prior to September the 11th, we were confident that two oceans could protect us from harm.
We spend hundreds of billions of dollars on defense, and it was the oceans that were protecting us in 2001? That was it? That was why no fancy fighter jets defended our airspace on September 11th? We bought the F-16s for show or to bomb and strafe other people? The oceans were for us. Great plan. One of my teenage daughters came to me last night worried that, as a somewhat public person, I might get in trouble if she posted this statement, she wrote, on Facebook. I grieve for the thousands of innocents who died on 9/11 if I can also grieve for the hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians who died in Iraq after 2003. I paused. Wow. Don't worry about me, I said. But if that's your experience and how you feel it, go for it. By the way, her first memory as a child on her first day of preschool on September 11th, 2001, was seeing a plane hit one of the towers and asking her mother, who saw nothing, why a plane would do that. 14 years later, we are all still working on that question from an innocent little girl. For the thousands of people who worked on the restoration of the World Trade Center and the rescue and recovery efforts there, the effects of the attacks 14 years ago live on inside their bodies. Ground Zero was a hazardous industrial site for months after the attacks. But the exact links between the World Trade Center site and the rate of illness in survivors and responders has been difficult to prove scientifically. Nevertheless, in 2010, Congress passed a law allocating more than $4 billion to cover the cost of medical expenses for responders and survivors of 9/11. Now the funds allocated by the legislation have almost run out, and the battle to save the program is being led by New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat, one of the leading proponents of making the compensation program permanent.
It would make a huge difference to our 9/11 heroes and to the families at Ground Zero because many of them are extremely ill. And if they are wondering whether their doctors will be there a year from now, or 2 years from now, or 5 years from now, that creates enormous anxiety. The number of cancers are growing that these 9/11 heroes are facing. In fact, more police officers have died from 9/11 related diseases than the number that died on 9/11.
And what are those diseases that the fund would cover and the links that justify this compensation?
So we have a 9/11 review process where all the diseases that are directly caused by 9/11 have been certified. And that includes things like lung cancer, stomach cancer, throat cancer, all sorts of respiratory diseases, prostate, thyroid, multiple myeloma, serious, serious illnesses that need care. And to have uncertainty about whether doctors and specialists and the money that's necessary to provide for treatment for our heroes is outrageous. And so that's why it needs to be permanent and it needs to be fully funded.
There are some people who say that the 9/11 attacks, of course, were unprecedented. But as an industrial site, there is not that much different about the World Trade Center and the Ground Zero site than other industrial sites in the United States, which begs the question, why does it get special funding and special compensation for the workers who work there?
Well, first of all, it was a terrorist attack, and it was the gravest terrorist attack in our nation's history. And the federal government told the people who were working on the pile that the air was safe. And men and women came all across the nation to answer the call of duty to be there at our nation's time of need. So the least we can do is stand by them at their time of need. But we also actually cover the healthcare of other types of workers that are extreme cases. For example, people who work in the nuclear industry. In 1990, we passed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. So there is precedent that for these extreme situations, that we, because of the heroism or duty of those who are doing very tough work, that we cover their healthcare. It's also not dissimilar from the commitment we make to our veterans. If you serve in combat, if you serve in the military, your healthcare is going to be covered through the VA. So it's very similar to how we treat other types of individuals who do extraordinary things or answer the call of duty.
I've never heard it explained that way, but it's interesting now that you mention it. You mentioned the nuclear industry, you mentioned other industrial hazardous workplaces. In a sense, you view this as equalizing the playing field for people at Ground Zero, not underscoring some sort of special compensation for them.
Correct. This is really what is due them because of their extraordinary work they did at a grave time of need, with assurances that you would be safe.
Right. And was the federal government wrong?
Yes, they were wrong. And the toxins that were released on 9/11 were deadly. And many people died right away from their illnesses. Many people developed illnesses over many, many years. As you know, mesothelioma is a lung disease that takes typically 20 years to develop. Massive amounts of asbestos was in the air because there was a lot of asbestos in those buildings.
Who's against this? And what sort of uphill battle do you face in the Senate and the House?
Well, no one is against it overtly, but I can tell you that there are too many people in Washington who are trying to cut this program to save a penny for no reason other than they're just cutting the program. They're not actually realizing these are people, these are heroes, these are firefighters and first responders and police officers and community members who were the victims of a horrible terrorist attack. And so, unfortunately, there are too many people around here who want to cut it and who want to limit it and want to make it 5 years, not permanent, and want to limit the amount of compensation. And they're wrong. And I think New Yorkers and people all across the United States who stand with our heroes need to tell Congress they have to support our 9/11 heroes and make sure they have basic health care.
Is there a clock ticking here?
There is. This program expires at the end of the month, and we need to make sure that money is there for these healthcare needs of our men and women who served. It's urgent, and I think the healthcare concerns are particularly urgent because even though there's still money in the healthcare bill to pay out different healthcare costs over the next several months, if there's uncertainty created that your doctor's not going to be available or he'll have to move his practice because the program's not going to be continued. That's outrageous. They shouldn't have to live with that anxiety. They shouldn't have to be lobbying Congress. Men and women who serve in Congress should be doing the right thing and standing by them.
Senator Gillibrand, before we go, I want to ask you about something that relates to conversations I've had with veterans who sometimes feel a little uncomfortable with this designation as hero, and they maybe have a different notion of what that is, and that saying hero is more about the comfort of people back home than it is of people on the battlefield. With that in mind, and with all due respect to your use of the term hero referring to 9/11 first responders, is there a moment when saying our 9/11 heroes will need to pass into the past?
I don't agree. I think that for these men and women who answered the call of duty, they are public servants first and foremost. They are police officers. They are firefighters. They're someone who risks their lives in the call of duty every single day. And when we asked them to help us on 9/11, they were the ones who raced up the towers when they were literally crumbling down. And they were racing up, saving people, getting them down, no thought or concern for themselves. So I think the designation of hero is accurate. I think it is appropriate. I think if someone feels uncomfortable, that's just their own view, but I consider them a hero. And if you remember the days after 9/11, those first responders were on the pile digging out debris, looking for survivors. And then they had the horrible job of having to look for remains. And that job lasted for weeks and months, all the while they're breathing these horrible toxins. And, you know, when we were first passing this bill 5 years ago, we had a memorial set up of the badges of police officers who had died since 9/11. The average age of those police officers was 42, very, very young, with young children, with families who died of horrible diseases that aren't typically seen until people are well into their 80s. So I think we need to stand by them and treat them as the heroes they are.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, Mr. Hockenberry, thanks for coming in. What'll it be today?
Hey, Doc, I'm here for an MRI and some blood work. Just want to see how everything's running.
Good idea. No problem. I'll just hook you up. Just climb into the dark tube here.
Okay, there we go. Squeeze in. I noticed that you don't have a price posted on your sign there.
Price? Posted? What do you think this is, a gas station? Now just lie back.
Man, that's loud.
Yeah, we're getting great pictures. Just sit still while the nurse takes your blood.
Ouch, that's a lot of blood. A
lot of tests, Mr. H. There we go.
Okay, how much do I owe you?
Got me. How much do you got? Why don't I just take it all?
I can't do that. I'll give you a couple of hundred. Is that okay?
Well, that'll work today.
Today? What do you mean today? What's the price of an MRI and some blood tests?
Got me. On Tuesday, it's different than Wednesday. Today's Friday, and did you drive here?
Yes.
That adds 20 bucks more.
What?
But if your wife came with you today, we could knock off 50 more even.
That's insane. Look, how much does an MRI cost you?
You mean how much does it cost for me to give someone an MRI?
Right. What?
Well, that's a good one. I have no idea. No one has ever asked that one. How much is an MRI, as if I would know?
This silly scene is actually a true story in healthcare. An MRI at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City will have one price, but the price is probably going to be different than an MRI down the street at Weill Cornell or at the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic or UCLA Medical Center. The president wants healthcare costs for consumers to come down. But Dr. Vivian Lee says that's impossible unless doctors understand their own costs. And she says they don't. And she's the CEO at University of Utah Healthcare, where they give a lot of MRIs.
It's funny you mention MRI because I am a radiologist, so I've spent a lot of time around MRI machines. One of the questions that our team asked was, what does it cost for every minute in the MRI scanner, every minute in the OR, every minute in the ER? Because once you fully appreciate the cost, then you can really start to question, well, how much time do we need to be spending in that scanner to make a good diagnosis and to be able to help the patient? And so, yes, to answer your question, we did calculate what it costs for every minute in each of those settings.
Now, knowing the cost, though, doesn't mean that you have to give up this negotiation process, because it depends on whether you're dealing with Medicare or which insurance provider, or if you're dealing actually with an indigent, the amount of revenue coming from each one of your customers can differ radically, right? So that doesn't change here so much.
You know, there's a that's a great question, John. And one of the real drivers right now is what we call payment reform or changes in the ways in which we are paid for delivering health care. And I think that at the core of it, these changes in payments, which Secretary Burwell is really driving out of HHS, which will really impact Medicare and Medicaid, and similarly many of the large health insurance companies are also driving, is actually really critical to our future, I think, in this country, because what they're trying to drive is rather than having each particular component negotiated and then the price negotiated for each part, whether it's an MRI or a CAT scan or a drug that you might have to take. Instead, what they're saying is, you know, let's pay providers for delivering great outcomes for patients. So if a patient comes in for a total hip replacement, if they have a great outcome, let's just pay providers a fixed lump sum for taking care of the patient and let them manage all the details of it. And in order to do something like that successfully as a healthcare system, we need to be able to internally measure the costs, measure the quality, measure the outcomes for each of those patients. So I think in order to help fix our healthcare system, we need to think about connecting more rationally the way in which we get paid to the kind of outcomes that our patients want. And for us to succeed in that environment, we need to have tools like our value-driven outcomes tool at the University of Utah.
Are patients better partners in keeping costs down if they know the cost of the services that they're getting, whether they're even paying for it or not?
We really believe in transparency. I think that patients, when they're engaged in their health care and when they understand what is happening, that's a better outcome for everyone, not just patients, but their families too. It's a team effort. At the University of Utah, about maybe 2.5-3 years ago, we actually undertook one of the first steps in transparency and in really gauging patients when we decided to post all of our patient satisfaction scores and comments from all of our patients that we receive on all the surveys that we get from them online. And we did this at the end of 2012. I think we were the first in the country, if I'm not mistaken. And it was a real success in terms of the way in which our patients felt about being able to have more insight. I mean, if you think about it, you wouldn't buy a toaster oven without looking for those 5 stars on Amazon or booking a hotel without looking at TripAdvisor, for example. Why should you have to pick a physician without knowing a little bit about what other patients thought about them?
If everybody did this, how much money do you think would be saved across the system in the U.S.?
There was an Institute of Medicine report a few years back that said about 30% of the healthcare dollar is lost due to waste. And I'll just tell you a story from our experience with our value-driven outcomes tool, this tool to measure outcomes and costs in healthcare at the University of Utah. And for about a year and a half, at the very beginning of this project, about 3 years ago, we started with a pilot project on total joint replacement, total hips, and total knees. And we measured outcomes, which were all, thankfully, very, very strong, consistently strong across all of our orthopedic surgeons. We also looked at costs. And when we gave this tool to our orthopedic surgeons, what they were really focused on was patient outcomes and really driving quality. They developed something called a perfect care index, and so they were driving towards perfect care for every single patient every time. And over the course of the year, while they were driving the quality continuously up, we saw a 32% reduction in costs, our costs to perform a hip or knee replacement. And that was without any financial incentive or inducement and with continued improved quality and very high patient satisfaction scores.
Dr. Vivian Lee is the CEO of the University of Utah Healthcare Center. Dr. Lee, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
Coming up, what experience have you had with hospital sticker shock? Do your medical bills make any sense to you, and are the charges fair? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from American Experience on PBS, presenting Walt Disney, featuring footage from the Disney archive and interviews with those who worked on his films. Walt Disney showcases the complex life and enduring legacy of one of America's most influential storytellers. A 2-night event beginning Monday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
When President Obama nominated Loretta Lynch for Attorney General, the president commended Lynch for her tough stance on white-collar crime.
As the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, she helped secure billions in settlements for people wronged by some of the world's biggest banks. She's been dogged in her pursuit of public corruption.
Now Lynch's Justice Department says it will focus on targeting individual white-collar criminals instead of institutions as a whole. What does that mean? Joining me is Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter for ProPublica. Welcome, Jesse.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this seems to reverse a strategy of Eric Holder, who preceded Loretta Lynch, who was able to use a tactic to basically turn banks to state's evidence, in a sense, to get huge settlement from the banks, but it ended up keeping the individuals from being prosecuted.
Yes. I mean, really what this is one of the great scandals of our time, which is that they don't investigate previously to this new change in policy. They haven't investigated individual accountability at the high corporate echelons. Instead, what they do is they settle with these corporations for huge amounts of money. And in turn, what they do is they grant immunity to the executives in return for bigger and bigger amounts of money. So they're trying to reverse this. They're trying to grapple with their inability to investigate and prosecute top corporate executives. And this is the first step to admitting they have a problem.
So when you say scandal, this was basically a kind of negotiating scheme where the government would come to a bank that had clearly exhibited wrongdoing and said, we'll give your executives immunity, but you have to give us a big settlement. In return, you have to testify and make our case kind of open and shut. That's no longer going to be the case?
What happened in these negotiations was that they would sort of start with the assumption that they were going to reach a deferred prosecution agreement, which is essentially a fancy term for a settlement. And they always had in their back of the minds, sure, if they give up the individuals, will take some individuals and hold them accountable, but they never really did. And the reason is that they weren't looking for the individuals at the beginning, and you have to do that from the beginning. The FBI has to investigate them. We have to build a case slowly over time. It takes much more time. It's much more difficult because individuals will fight while a corporation will settle because the corporation is settling with not their money. They're settling with shareholder money.
So this sense of intimidation of litigating big executives at big banks is perhaps the reason why one of the only people who's actually convicted and sitting in prison for any of these insider trading allegations or anything like that is that South Asian fellow who was profiled in The New Yorker for insider trading on medical devices.
Well, on insider trading, they got a lot of guys from hedge funds. One of the reasons they did was they developed a huge amount of direct evidence. They had wiretaps. Those are relatively easy cases to make, and they're discrete businesses. You know, Raj Rajaratnam's hedge fund is not going to cause systemic problems in the financial markets if it closes up shop. They have huge trepidation taking on J.P. Morgan or Citigroup because they worry about incorrectly, in my view, they worry about the collateral consequences of the rocky effects of the financial markets.
Is there any institution or set of individuals who might be expected, before we go here, to be most afraid of this decision?
Well, I mean, this is the great closing the barn door if the cows are out memo of our time because, you know, most of the statute of limitations have run on the crimes that I believe were committed in the wake of the financial crisis. So, you know, there are cases that are in the works now against pharmaceutical companies. Walmart is facing foreign corrupt practices. We may see increased cooperation, but now the proof will really be whether they can bring these charges and whether they do it or whether this is just a memo. It's easy to write a memo.
We certainly live in interesting times when a memo from the Justice Department says, we're going to prosecute criminals, and that's news.
I know. It's at least the memo does one thing, which is a tacit admission, finally, that they do have a terrible problem with this. You know, this is a 12-step program, and they have taken the first step in admitting they have a problem.
Jesse Eisinger is a senior reporter for ProPublica. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Zeina Erhaim is one of the few young reporters who reports from inside Syria. For the past 2 years, she's been living in and reporting from Aleppo. You heard her brave voice at the top of the hour talking about an attack at a school. But Zena's even more remarkable work inside Syria has been to train young reporters to tell their stories to the outside world. Here, a seventh grader named Mohammed Kotesh talks about the papier-mâché model he built that shows how he wants to someday rebuild his city, Aleppo, and its streets of rubble. Through this exhibition, I want to show how I would rebuild Syria in the future, he says, and to inspire everyone who has such talent to develop it and take part in rebuilding it. My dream is to become an architect. Zena Erheim is the Syria Project Coordinator at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and this year received the Peter Mackler Award for Courageous and Ethical Journalism. Zena has acquired the wisdom of someone who at her young age has seen what humans are capable of in both cruelty and strength. And as you'll hear, it's a burden she carries that is also a gift to all of us, with hope for the people of Syria.
There was a neighbor of mine. She is a widow. She has 6 kids. And she stopped allowing her kids to go to school. And I was speaking with her, asking her why. She said, well, I know our lives are in the hands of God and we can't prevent death, but I just want to be killed with my children. So it's her choice is not to protect her kids from being killed, but just to be killed altogether because she doesn't want herself or her kids to suffer from losing the other family members.
Given how long things have gone on and what the civilians have had to endure, do you ever have a chance to ask the fighters, you know, what it is they're fighting for at this point?
They're now in kind of a defensive position. If the regime took over the city, not only the activists and the rebels are going to be killed, mostly massacred, but also the civilians, because they're going to be punished for accepting to be under the rebels' control. So even for civilians who are neutral and they don't have this political position against the regime, they do feel that the rebels are kind of their secure guards in a way.
And does that include ISIS? Do people believe that ISIS can protect them? Are there some people who are happy to live under ISIS, even given all of the horrors that they're responsible for?
A family of my friend is living in Al Bab, which is under ISIS control. And when they came once to visit us in Aleppo City, they couldn't bear one day. They said, we want to go back to ISIS because there, the regime doesn't bomb. So it's safer for them to be there because the regime only bombs these areas that are controlled by rebels, but not those who are controlled by ISIS. And this is not very far from my own personal experience. But for those who are living under ISIS, for sure they can't express how much they hate it because it's scary and they're scared.
Have you ever looked into the eyes of one of the armed militia or regime or pilots even and seen them look at you as though you're next?
Well, I passed checkpoints, even ISIS checkpoints in 2013. I was scared, especially from ISIS, and I had to have another ID, not to be recognized as a journalist or as an activist. I was even kidnapped once by Shiite militias in 2013, maybe. But my main fear is the sky. This is what I'm mostly scared of, because this is inevitable. This is something that I can't run away from. I can avoid some checkpoints. I can avoid ISIS by not going to their areas. But the fight jet, the Air Force, is something I can't avoid.
Zena, you've done remarkable stories and have told stories that no one else can tell or has told. There are journalists who've worked in Aleppo who died trying to get the same stories that you've gotten. I mean, this isn't exactly the most polite question to ask, but if out of the sky a missile kills you tomorrow, what will you have accomplished?
Well, I haven't been as much journalist as I wished for. I'm mostly now a media development worker. What I was trying to do in these last 2 years, or maybe even 3, is helping those citizen journalists who want to deliver their stories and publish their news is just to help them, giving them the tools to express themselves rightly and put them in touch with the right media to put this information and stories. So my main work was training those and helping them out in doing their stories. So in terms of the amount of stories I have produced personally, it's not compared to the amount of people that I have trained and their stories. And although I feel kind of guilty because I'm not doing that much for myself, but I feel so much proud when I see their stories and how professional it is. So I kind of see my achievements through them. And even if I'm killed, I know that I have 1,000 citizen journalists who I helped, not only in getting journalistic skills, but also to be recognized as journalists and to work with international and local media. They will go on. Well, I do love life a lot, and I will be saddened if I'm killed. But this is our destiny. I wouldn't go to another country to report war. I always wondered why do journalists go to war zones. But this is my home. This is my country.
All right, Zana, you take care of yourself now.
Thank you. I'm doing my best.
Zana Erheim has been living in and reporting from Aleppo, Syria for the past 2 years. She's the Syria Project Coordinator at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and won the Peter McClure Award for Courageous and Ethical Journalism in 2015. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.